This is session number 66, recorded on February 23rd, 2009. It's me and Scott as usual, but we have a guest, Dave Neufeld, who's staying with me here in Maui, in the Hawaiian Islands. So Dave might be adding some stuff. As a matter of fact, I think Dave has a question.
Yeah, I guess a good opening question, since I'm a bit of a aversion to this, is Scotty, you've been doing this stuff with Bob. Tell me how you met Bob and just how this has all developed. Like, tell us.
Yeah, well, I was in L.A. When I met Bob, and it was, you know, I always kind of felt like I was supposed to meet Bob because I was working a night shift, and I came home from work, and it was Sunday morning, and my girlfriend had rearranged some things, including my little radio, which my radio had to be just in the right position in order for the antenna to pick up KPFK, which I like to listen to at night, the Roy of Hollywood show. But it was Sunday morning, and I would normally not ever turn my radio on Sunday morning, but I saw that it had been, stuff had been shuffled around, and so I readjusted it, and I turned it on just to make sure that the antenna was lined up right and tuned into KPFK, and Bob's on there, well, on the Dave Porter show. I hear this guy talking, and I wasn't really tuning into what he was saying, but I got the antenna all lined up right, and I turned it off, and then something was bugging me, and I thought to myself, what the hell was that guy saying? So I went back and turned it back on again, and after a few minutes, I thought to myself, holy shit, I gotta take a better listen to what he's saying. So I turned on a tape deck that I had that was hooked up to a more heavy-duty stereo system and recorded the show. I got probably the last 30 minutes of it at the end of the show. Jerry Fialka said, you know, for anybody that wants more information, and he gave out his phone number, and I called Jerry, like, right away. I just was hooked immediately.
So when was that? How long ago was that?
That would have been, I think you did a couple rounds on the Dave Porter show, Bob. Maybe it was 92 or 3.
That's what's going back, eh?
No, it was, I started Dave Porter in the sequence that Scott heard on May Brussels' birthday, May 29th, 1993.
Okay.
And I was at Jerry's till August, and I moved to New York. And it continued through till September 94 when Porter was taken off the air. The show was called Genesis of a Music, I think that's what it was. So it was probably sometime in 94, like I had left, so definitely it was after I left, Scott. I wasn't there for you to meet. If you'd called in summer 93, I was there. So it was in 94 sometime.
When you were on Dave Porter or when we met?
No, on Dave Porter. Well, I was on Dave Porter from May 29th, 93 to September 94. It's in sometime in 94 where you had this experience where you heard me.
Right. And
until the summer of 95.
Right.
But anyway, so you called up Jerry. What happened?
Yeah, I said I wanted to get some more whatever information he had available about you and who were you and so on. And Jerry offered to make I had this deal with Jerry. That was so cool. I thought I was getting a really good deal. All I had to do was bring him two blank tapes. He would keep one. That would be the payment. And then he would take the other one and he would record something that he had from his he'd already collected some you know, Bob audio stuff. And so I started collecting Bob talks from Jerry, and I got to know Jerry, and that turned into a really special friendship for me. Jerry was always very hospitable to me, and I liked Jerry a lot. And then Jerry set up the those great phone sessions where he set up a speaker and a microphone in his house, and he'd have maybe four or five of us come over, and we'd talk to you from New York.
Yeah, that was after Porter show was over. There was a political shakeup, and he got knocked out among other people.
Right.
And so Jerry wanted more Bob. Scott wanted more Bob. Can you think of how many shows you heard of me on Porter? Did you hear 10 shows, 3 shows?
Well, how many shows did you do in that series when Robert Anton Wilson called in?
Yeah, May 29th, 93 on is it's about 13 shows. I think it was on once every 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that. And it wasn't on, you know, often, but it was regular. Once every 2 months. So you get about 18, you get about 16 months there. So I guess maybe it was every month, once a month, not every second month. But it turns out to be about 14 shows, according to Guffey. 13 shows. So you probably heard 3 shows, say, and then it was over, right?
Yeah, I guess. I didn't realize you did that many.
No, I did it for, you know, that period of time. There's 13 two-hour editions.
Mm-hmm.
So Jerry wanted more Bob, so he said Scott was interested, Michael Shields was interested, Mark Free might have been part of them, and another guy, maybe Kyle. That all sounds familiar, right?
Yep.
Kyle was a blind guy. He'd come and listen. And so we started in October, and we did it for like 6 months. And so Scott got to know me more in detail through those phone calls. I'd call from New York.
Mm-hmm.
I probably called. And but the thing is, Scott, tell them about what your interests were on Roy of Hollywood before.
Yeah, I'd been a fan of Roy of Hollywood. I couldn't always be there when his show was on, so I got this big reel-to-reel tape deck that you could get like 5 hours of recording on, and I plugged and I set it up with a timer, and I would record his show on certain evenings he had different formats on different evenings, but there were a couple of nights a week when I would record his show, and then dub it to cassette tape, and then listen to it in my car on the way back and forth to work. And so, you know, he had all the New Age people on there. I took a liking to Terrence McKenna, who Roy of Hollywood made famous. I had been a fan of people in the consciousness expansion movement, like John Lilly and Roy played Krishnamurti on his show, and Alan Watts.
When did you get into E.J. Gold? In that period?
No, that was before then. I found his book, The American Book of the Dead, in 1974, when I was living in Woodland Hills. I guess I was 25 years old or something. Or no, I'm 20. I don't remember how old I was.
When were you born?
56.
Well, you were 18.
Yeah, I was 18. Yeah, that's right.
And Woodland Hills is where Beefheart lived before he moved up Northern California. I'd been at Beefheart's house there. So what? That's where 12 Masked Ruppers was recorded. So I don't know. You should check how close you were to his address, Scott.
Yeah. Well,
now, you were a high school guy. In high school, you were a musician, and then you became a surfer. Or you were both?
Both.
You used to live in the high school California dream, Dave. You surfing, music, electric guitar. You were lead guitar?
Yeah, you know, I'd hesitate to call myself a musician, but I, you know, I noodled around and was in a band.
And, okay, so E.J. Gold was your first New Age influence.
You know, 1955, 1956 is supposed to be one of the best years in human history to have been born.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, you avoided the Vietnam War. You were too old to be drafted into a war. When you graduated, the economy was not pretty good. By the time you were in your 30s, the computer thing was really coming on strong, so you're still kind of young enough to adapt to a, you know, a new technology kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, that's a year, I guess, you're 56, but 55 is when Bill Gates is born, I think, and Steve Jobs.
Right.
Yeah.
Good point, Dave.
Sometimes I'd wished I was born a little earlier, because I was a little young when all the you know, hippie scene was happening. I didn't get to participate in that as a young adult. I was a little too young, but but nevertheless, I was being imprinted with all that great music.
You totally, eh?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, in the interview that Bob did with you, you talked about you inherited an album collection from somebody.
Oh, a few, yeah. People would give me. I remember the one guy, Jim Main, he gave you 10 Years After and the Woodstock soundtrack and Led Zeppelin 1 and 2. And
right.
All this great stuff.
Yeah. I remember you talking about how delicious it was it totally, to use Bob's term, hoiked up that experience for me, which I had kind of forgotten about. I mean, so many things have happened since then. I hadn't really thought about it, but I got shivers up my spine thinking about, because the same thing happened to me. My grandmother managed an apartment building, and when some people abandoned the apartment and there was all this stuff in there, and I inherited this box of about, you know, 40 wow. rock and roll albums, including, you know, early Beatles and Rolling Stones and Joni Mitchell and Joan Baez and everybody. And it was just, you know, I get in a candy store.
Got gold, yeah.
How old were you then?
Nine years old.
That's the same as Dave.
Yeah.
Same age.
Grade 4 or 5 kind of thing.
Yeah.
Grade 4, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Fun, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I loved it, too. I remember saying to Bob and the thing, especially when I remember A Whole Lot of Love, I thought, these guys are on drugs, when you're all a backwards echo. I thought, this is drug music. And then when it went to that, I remember just freaking out and, like, playing it for my mom. Listen to this.
Yeah.
And I had this, like, you know, $39 crap little turntable that the speaker was built right into it, and it didn't matter on when the minute that blistering guitar solo, that thing would cut through like anything.
What song was that?
On A Whole Lot of Love.
Oh.
They sort of break down. I never heard on a Beatles album ever a guitar sound so bitchin'. I was just blown away.
Yeah.
That was it. From then on in, I just wanted to be that. I wanted to get in front of all the kids in the school and sing like Robert Plant, play guitar like Jimmy Page, and rock the drums like John Bonham. The Beatles, who wouldn't like that?
Right, yeah.
An exciting band, and just fun to listen to, and their career was so diverse. And yeah, they're just amazing.
Yeah.
So E.J. Gold gave you a different way to look at things.
Well, no. When when I picked up the American Book of the Dead, it was a translation. It was it was adapted from the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and I don't know. I was always bugged by the idea that, you know, I was going to die or that we're all going to die. I mean, that bugged me from a young age, and so
a little bit of a flaw. It was a flaw in consciousness.
Yeah.
I think it's weird. For me, I didn't even know young people think too much about their own personal death.
Yeah. When I saw that somebody had, you know, really focused their attention on it in terms of writing this book about the stages of the processes that the Tibetans had tracked or mapped out or whatever. Yeah, it became one of my, you know, books on the bookshelf that was always there.
And how did you find it?
I was in the section there where they have psycho-spiritual stuff at the bookstore in the plaza in the mall. I think it was, wasn't Borders. Well, I think it was called Walden Books back then.
which city is this?
In Woodland Hills.
In Los Angeles, right.
But that was around the same time that I got a hold of the autobiography of a yogi, which also made a very deep impression on me. I was blown away by that book.
So you were in high school or out of high school? You were 18.
I was just finishing. The first book that I saw was Be Here Now. Somebody had some girl sitting next to me in class had it, and I was kind of shy about, you know, just approaching girls out of the blue, but I saw she had this book. I said, what do you have? Can I look at that? You know, and wow, look at this. And then I went to the bookstore looking for it, and I saw Yogananda's book, Autobiography of Yogi, so I got that. And then it was probably shortly after that that I saw the Tibetan book. I bought both a translation of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which was more true to the original Book of the Dead. It was translated by Evans Vance, and he was the first guy to translate it. And then he was kind of a literal translation from the Tibetan into English. And then Leary, Alpert, and Metzner did the Psychedelic Experience, which was their adaptation of the American Book of the Dead. And then John Lilly got into the book, and he recommended it to EJ. And so he said, you know, nobody's really done a good investigation of this material. So EJ wrote the American Book of the Dead, and then when it was still in manuscript form, John Lilly had a friend who died, and John Lilly read the book for his friend who was going through the Bardos. So that's a little history on
read EJ Gold's book,
right?
And you said Leary and them translated, or Psychedelic Experience was the American Book of the Dead. You meant the Tibetan Book of the Dead?
Yeah, it was their take on the Tibetan Book of the Dead.
So, but the American Book of the Dead is a translation?
Well,
an update with pop culture environments or something?
Yeah, it's morphed for the Western archetypes, the Western mind, you know. I mean, the Tibetan Book of the Dead has all that weird Tonka imagery of all the Buddhas and the devils and all that wild ass imagery, which you can't really, if you're a Westerner, you don't really relate to it. So EJ used archetypes that are familiar to the Western consciousness and translated the book using imagery that we could all relate to, that Americans could relate to.
Right. So Lilly was a longtime friend of E.J. Gold.
Yeah.
And what is the essence of Leary's offerings that you got from him? What was it about him that inspired you or edified you?
I was more taken with EJ's book, actually, but I added Leary's book to my collection. Leary was using psychedelics to try to...
I said Lilly.
Oh, Lilly.
Yeah, what is the essence that you got from Lilly, which is later, right?
No, it was probably also around the same time that I picked up Lilly's book, The Center of the Cyclone. He'd been down in South America with Oscar Chasso.
Yeah, and that group is what Jodorowsky's movie El Topo, or The Holy Mountain, maybe it's more The Holy Mountain, is based on.
That oh, yeah.
Guru.
Well, I'd like to see that. I don't know about that movie.
Okay. Famous mid-70s movie, The Holy Mountain, by Jodorowsky.
Mm-hmm.
And also El Topo came out before it. Yeah, check those out. So that's how I know Oscar Caizo. He came out of Esalen and went down to Argentina or something.
Right.
He had a bit of a Gurdjieff take or something. But
right.
Lilly was part of that group, eh?
Yeah, mm-hmm.
And then he came back from that, and what happened?
He finally left because he felt that he was beginning to reach a level of, he was in a sense becoming a peer with Oscar Chasso, however you pronounce his name, and Oscar Chasso was playing games. He didn't want anybody to reach the top of the pyramid where he was. So he was playing some kind of games, and Lilly felt that he was being oppressed or suppressed or something. He decided to leave. And it was after that he wrote The Center of the Cyclone, and
Is that about dolphins, or had he already done the dolphins?
No, he did other books on the dolphins. He may go into the dolphins and the center of the cyclone. I'm not sure. It's been a long time.
A cyclone that goes into cosmic coincidence control?
Well, he maps out these levels of consciousness. There's a grid that there's like 24 stages of plus states and 24 stages of minus states of consciousness that he lays out. And I'd have to go back and pick up the book really to investigate it with you because it's been a long time. But
okay, so that's what you get from Lilly. And then in the 80s, you get your next major impact is McKenna.
Yeah.
And what did you get from McKenna? What was the point of inspiration there?
Well, McKenna was an oral bard, and so he was on the radio. Don't have a lot of lectures by Lilly. You have his books. And McKenna was investigating... he felt that culture was in crisis, and he thought that, if you could get down to the primal state of consciousness, that the virgin state of consciousness that the shamans were into. I'm fumbling around here because I'm trying to put this all back together in my mind. It's been years since I've been into all this stuff, but... psychedelics had entered into America through and Tim Leary was an advocate of that, and so it was having an impact on consciousness, and there was all the MK Ultra stuff going on, and McKenna thought there were some kind of keys to the cultural crisis that we were going through, embedded in the psychedelic state. But if you were going to do psychedelics in America, you were going to be contaminated by all of the crap that was going on in the American site and in the American scene. So he wanted to go down and take it with the shaman, with the guys who'd been doing it for 1,000 years, and find out what it was really about. So he went down there with his brother, and he had these amazing experiences, and he came up with the time wave zero, which is incredible. Piece of software. I can't deny that the thing has an authenticity, which is pretty extraordinary. And just that from that alone. But then you add to the fact that he was so he was a wordsmith. He the way that he told stories, told the stories about his trips to the Amazon, his voice imbued the mushroom. It imbued the psychedelic experience. You could get high listening to him talk. And so I don't know if that answers your question.
Well, what I think of is through our many hours talking about my book, Vedic Communion, they were like anchors in your mind. You'd refer to McKenna, you'd refer to Lilly, you'd refer to Leary, you'd refer to E.J. Gold. These came up recycled regularly through your response to LaRouche, McLuhan, Thompson, and Croker.
Right.
And you say that it all, you were meant to meet me. How does Lilly, McKenna, Gold, Leary, and Almas Krishnamurti prepare you for me or lead to me?
Well, I had the Thompson attraction, and when I heard you, all that other stuff sort of became obsolete in a way. I stopped listening to Terrence. I didn't really care anymore. I stopped listening. It was probably within 6 months of starting to hear your talks and then meet you, I stopped listening to KPFK altogether. I started sending, I sent a couple of letters to Roy. I'd met Roy. Here I am, a sincere fan of the show, and I'm saying, Roy, you got to, take a look at this guy, see if you can get him on the air. And I was kind of surprised when Roy had just, shut his mind to you altogether, and I kind of lost interest in all of that programming up to that stage. I thought that you had a fresher, newer, better overview. You understood. You seemed to understand a lot of. See, I had been involved for a period of a couple of years with a particular channel, who, in my opinion, was of the quality of the Evergreens, but maybe not. You probably wouldn't agree with that, but the quality was impressive enough to me that I knew it was authentic. Because I had seen some channels that were a little creepy and they put me off, and I wasn't too sure about them. But this particular one, I knew this phenomena was real. And you were referencing the Evergreens, and you were referencing, And the thing that I liked about McKenna was that after reading like the yogi stuff, the guys who were meditating and going deep into trance, and McKenna was asking questions about all of that, and he was asking questions about the old spiritual traditions in light of what was happening in culture in the Western mind, and you were doing that too. You were questioning, and also I had an intuition that I was going to meet you when I was very young, like probably like 12 years old, because I remember having a conversation with somebody and falling into an awareness that language itself was key to understanding consciousness. And then you, with your background in McLuhan, you seem to understand language on levels and meta levels that I had never heard anybody before express. And
so who was the medium? I don't know if I recall you talking about a medium that you knew.
Yeah, I've told you about Lazarus.
Oh, Lazarus.
Yeah.
Lazarus. Right,
yeah.
Right. You attended his sessions?
Yeah, and more significantly, I had spoken with him on the phone privately on several occasions, and what he told me about myself was authentic, and nobody could have possibly known what he told me. And he told me stuff that he said probably wouldn't make sense for even, it would even make more sense as my life progressed, and that's been true.
You tape it?
Yeah.
So you have that?
Yeah.
And that was a private session?
Yeah.
And you paid for it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So what was his price? Do you remember?
I think an hour was $100 or something.
Right. And what year was that?
That would have been around 70. Let's see. Well, you figure it out. I was like 25 years old.
So 81.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're born in 56, so 25 to 81. Yeah, he was one of the first of the popularization of channeling in the 80s. You know, you had him, you had Rampla, and you had Shirley MacLaine, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So what was the other thing? You were talking about Lazarus and then the levels. Now, when was the time you read McLuhan and was to walk on the beach early in the morning or something? Is that in the late 90s?
Yeah.
Yeah, and that that was a weird experience for you, right? When you actually started reading Understanding Media.
But I wouldn't have ever stumbled across it on my own had you not turned me on to it.
Right, and you actually attended LaRouche meetings, got involved with LaRouche at some point.
Mm-hmm.
In there. And now you say you were in the Thompson experience. You mean you came from naturally from your late teens from the Thompson quadrant as we understand it, right? That's what you mean.
Yeah. Quadrant. I mean, I had gotten involved with an occult group that was not too unlike the Golden Dawn and that kind of stuff. And I remember we were body surfing. We were out in the water on Zuma Beach, and we were talking and
Just from Dylan's home.
Yeah, and you're talking about the 23 vibe and the 22 vibe, and I just sort of got it that all that old occult stuff, that 23 vibe, was obsolete.
And you're saying the occult group was EJ Gold?
No, that was the BOTA, actually. It was an offshoot of the Golden Dawn.
Oh, so you have a similar experience as Corbin?
Yeah, to some degree. Corbin has gone into it more deeply than I.
And how old were you when that happened?
Well, it was actually through my connection with Mark Free, which was another connection that happened through Jerry. When I was at Jerry's place, you know, getting my Bob fix, I saw a business card that had a beautiful image of the Tree of Life and all the 10 Sephiras and all the pathways connecting all the Sephiras using the Tarot deck, and I just, you know, I immediately gravitated to it. I said, Jerry, where did you get this? And he said, oh, it was my friend Mark. So as soon as I was introduced to Mark, I showed him the card. I said, Mark, what's this? And so he introduced me to the BOTA.
Right. I've been to that place, the temple or something.
Yeah.
He took me there. So that's like 95, 96, 97, and it's after that that you read Understanding Media.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think I knew that you got involved with the Mark scene, Mark Free scene.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what do you, Dave? Okay, Dave, that's how he met me. And then what did you think of all that stuff now, Scott, after our discussions in the Fatty Communion for several years and all that we've gone through the last couple of years?
Think of what stuff?
The McKenna, the...
All right.
BOTA, is it BOTA? What's that stand for?
The Builders of the Adidom.
Okay.
Well, I still have an appreciation for all that stuff, you know? It's like if I was an art collector and I had collected some, and I had a collection that spanned, you know, a number of years, I might still, you know, like a lot of my old art pieces, and I might prize a lot of them. But then I also might have new additions that take me into new areas. So I haven't,
abandoned
it. Yeah, I haven't abandoned it all entirely, but I don't focus on it too much. I don't seek out that stuff or study it, really.
Well, the Bob Carr book, then, is a good review of all that from a different perspective than you would expect, right?
Yeah.
Oh, you didn't read the book. You just heard him talk.
Right.
Yeah. So Bob Carr is a bit of a shock. His because during your talk, listening to our talks with Bob Carr, you could say, oh, I went through a lot of that too as a young person, a lot that he went through.
Yeah, and I was already reasonably familiar with Krishnamurti. I'd, you know, probably logged 100 hours of listening to Krishnamurti on the Roy Tuckman show. So when I first, I was suspicious when I first started to hear the story about the UG Krishnamurti, and it took a while for it to sink in that UG Krishnamurti was every bit as authentic
as Jiddu
Krishnamurti, and maybe even took it a step further.
That's what you're still thinking about now.
Yeah.
So Dave, Mumbai, Bob Carr, we did these interviews with Bob Carr, who
mm-hmm.
started the Cosmic Awareness Movement indirectly by being a big influence on Dave Worster. And Bob Carr and Dave Worster were the first people to get LSD from Captain Al Hubbard in a non-medical context. They weren't schizophrenics, they weren't alcoholics.
Mm-hmm.
And so they started the spread of LSD. Not intentionally.
What year is that? 1957?
57 to 60.
Okay.
And Bob Carr went on involved with everything. His partner created poster art, acid poster art, and just goes on.
Hmm.
Many amazing things that he happened to be first in.
And why did he pick those guys to do the experiment?
Al Hubbard was looking for intelligence, psychically and sensitive people,
mm-hmm.
and he found these guys. Bob Carr had created the Center of Integration in Seattle.
And that's the Ron Hubbard that's founded?
No, this is Captain Al Hubbard.
Okay.
He was the Tim Leary of the 50s who would give LSD to elites. He didn't believe in spreading around among the people.
Okay.
But through the Bob Carr world and Dave Wurster world, it snuck out from them and started to get up and down the California coast and across the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a few years before Tim Leary showed up.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a well-known history. Mm-hmm. So we got 18 hours of interview with Bob Carr.
Huh.
But he lives in Mumbai. So starting in the fall, we're talking to Bob Carr in Mumbai and learning about Mumbai, which is the name for Bombay,
okay.
New name. And then the terrorism happened in the middle of that.
Yeah.
And then it had its whole lifestyle advertised in the movie Slumdog. Was it Slumdog?
Millionaire,
which won the Oscars yesterday.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Another.
I had this mini shocking experience, which was that I had been talking with, after you started interviewing and I was recording your interview with Bob Carr, I spoke with Bob Carr personally, and while I was talking with him, I was getting a fix on where he lived in Mumbai, and I was using Google satellite map. So I'm looking at a satellite image of Mumbai, and I'm zooming in and out different regions of the area. And then it was like within a day or two, I see the same satellite image on TV related to the fact that Mumbai was under attack by these terrorists. And it was a bit odd.
Yeah, to have your own personal experience collectivized.
Yeah.
A kind of a xenochrony.
Right.
So the Scott, you got any questions for Dave?
Yeah, I'm curious to know how far you and Bob go. You guys go back, don't you? Did you you were part of the CKLN show back then with Bob Marshall and Dave and Mike Dyer and all that? Were you part of that group?
I was actually before Mike Dyer, and then Mike Dyer took over afterwards. So yeah, no, I'm basically CKLN from 84 to 86.
Oh,
when Bob was doing his top down stuff, or Bob Dobbs.
You mean Bob Marshall?
Bob Marshall.
You had a show? You had a show, Dave?
I was a news director, so I would every day was responsible for an hour show, 11 till noon. And then on the Saturday mornings, then there was another show, about 2 hours worth. What was it called? I forget what that was called.
International Connection, Saturday edition.
Yeah.
Oh, you were Five of the Eight or before Five?
Something like that, yeah.
And we were part of 1 hour of that and International Connection.
Mm-hmm. So that's how I met Bob Marshall, and then they sacked me from the station because I didn't get along with the management there. And so that was the end of me there, but we stayed in touch, and then Bob Dobbs started doing this show with Mike Dyer, and then I met him, and we just stayed friends. And then I guess also there was the Nelson Thal connection, and they were friends. And so I started doing a show over at a rival college station with Bob Dobbs. Would you say that was Bob Dobbs? That one?
Oh yeah,
yeah,
yeah. No, that
with was Nelson. And what was that? That was the Midweek Report.
Yeah, and we did
that
special
good.
On McClune.
Yeah, and that was for a few months. I did that, and then I just thought, fuck, fucking working for free. If I'm going to put that much energy into other stuff that hardly anyone's listening to or gives a shit about, I'm just going to start my own business. And so that's right when the Mac Plus kind of came in by the late 80s then. And suddenly it's like MIDI came in. Suddenly it was like, feasible to actually make sort of a cool sounding dance style record with in your bedroom. So that really appealed to me rather than working with bands, and so that's kind of how I met Bob, and then later Bob, who I'm sitting here with, and then from there then Nelson then put up money to make the Bob records, and then I made the McClune album. and that just kind of solidified things. That's kind of my history with those guys.
Were those big projects for you at the time, or were you working?
I totally broke, so that was a money saver, money maker.
Wow.
Yeah, no, he gave me about $4,000 to make the first Bob album, which was a lot of money for me then. Because I mean, you know, back then, you know, my apartment was $275 a month. So
that was December '90, going through '91.
Yeah. And then the McLuhan album, money-wise, was the one, the more lucrative one. Because actually the second Bob album I made when I was already working on the McLuhan album. And there was kind of a need, we've got to do a follow-up album with remixes and, you know, and get some name brand people. So we had got Negative Land to do it, and this guy Steinsky, who, by the way, you know, he released that Bob track on his The Best of Steinsky, or the thing that, and that was one of the highest rated albums last year on the Metacritic. I noticed the average mark was like 94. People raved about it. And then the
you're saying that Steinsky released his greatest hits, and he considered what he had done for your Bob
as part of it. Well, I don't know if he called it so much greatest hits, just here's what I did kind of thing. And then
Cold Cut,
exactly.
British group,
British guys. There's another one. That's on the Bob's Media College too. I don't know if Bob's if he's given you that stuff or you have recordings of it. It's out there. Didn't that get posted up, Bob, already?
Yeah, no. Scott has Bob's Ecology Square.
Yeah, I have both the albums plus the McLuhan album.
Yeah.
I got them
from
Jerry.
Ah, cool. What, like just copies of the CDs?
No, I got the record, the album art and everything.
Those are actually pretty rare albums, eh? There's, I think, 1,000 copies printed of each of those albums.
Yeah. No, they're prized possessions of mine.
Oh, cool.
I think they're terrific.
Do you like that McLuhan record? Do you like the McLuhan one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was, I didn't know how to get my hands on any McLuhan material. I don't know how much McLuhan material's out there, but I'm starting to see it all over YouTube now, so apparently people are dredging up McLuhan stuff and recordings, videos, and audio stuff that he did, and it's out there. It's starting to emerge. But that was the only audio McLuhan that I was able to get my hands on, so it was terrific.
Yeah, and the Buzz Costin, have you been looking at some of the stuff he's been doing on YouTube?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Yep.
Have you been hearing those Cash Flow shows?
Yeah, I listen to them.
They're pretty amazing, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah, I find Bob really shines on those shows. I mean, he shines on all the stuff. Right, Bob? Well, of course you do.
Well, you haven't heard how bad I am on International Connection lately.
Really?
You might not think I'm shining on that.
What, are you just goofing around? You don't care? Or what is it?
Well, I'm in the secondary Ed McMahon role.
Right, that's the thing. That show's kind of a bit of anarchy, too. And a lot of just laughing and being silly.
Yeah, listen to this. This is it. This is relevant. There's this guy, you know, KK Scott. You may have noticed his post on the McLuhan list.
Yeah.
Okay. He also is known as TM. He wrote an email to Greg. Let's see. Can we get that quickly? I'll go over here just a second. KK. It's interesting what he sent today. I think this relates to what I mean to Dave. He writes, okay, so, TM. Okay, so he writes this. This is on February 20th. It's purple. There's no TV in your world, but you love YouTube? Thought you might find this Super Bowl ad worthy of your attention and possible comment. Even gives a shout out to the reptilians in Bobulus. Don't know what that is. I haven't looked at YouTube.
Oh, it's funny. You got to see it.
Okay, so he says, what is Bobulus? Bob Rules. Oh, it's Bob Rules. Reptilians in Bob Rules? Not YouTube? You know what he means?
Yeah, you got to see the YouTube, though.
Okay. Okay, so he says, your last cash flow show was nuttier than a Zappa lyric. And I talked a lot about Zappa's cheese concept. James sounded seriously jammed by your pronouncements and pontificating. James sounded seriously jammed by your pronouncements and pontificating, explaining why your team pulled off a December 12th $500 billion run on the banks. It was a verbal high-wire act, second to none, veering as it did from one incredulity to another while sprinkling the probes with arcane sound bites, and would have made McLuhan proud. That so few are awake to appreciate this act is a crime. So he likes the cash flow. He then made an email. I don't have it right now. I probably sent Greg. So he then sends this email to me, and I forward it to Greg, and it says, okay, says cell phone can't be turned off. He says, James, you're really, really good at constantly pushing Bob to greater and greater heights. Wish Greg Duffel would listen to your show. He's such a bore. Now, he's addressing this to James. Please have Mr. Neverett explain how the USA came to being just 3 hours away from economic political collapse in September 2008. I've listened to Bob everywhere, and not even on the International Connection has he revealed just how or why he masterminded this. James, you're the only one capable of grilling Bob about this matter. Then he goes into it. He says, I realize Bob has no fear, in brackets, he lives on a secluded beach, and doesn't take Democracy Now seriously. But James, you'll love this 10-minute interview. So then, okay, that makes sense. So, let's see, just a second. All right, I think I got it here. The previous. Okay. I forwarded that. What I just read you is what I about. He says Greg Duffel's a bore. And forward that to Greg of International Connection. So then back here, Greg says, why don't you phone in? He tells KK, well, if you think I'm a bore, phone in on our Sunday show. And Greg will address his complaint about him being boring. So I forward that to, well, so after Sunday's show, KK, Kling Klang, this guy, he didn't phone in. So I write to him, hey KK14, that's what he calls himself, which is KK's 11, right? So 211 is 22. Hey, KK14, you didn't phone in. Or did you, but couldn't get through? So here's what he says. And this is, goes back to what you're saying, what I said to you, Dave, that I'm, you might not be happy with what I do in CKLN, or be, think it's scintillating. He says, Duffel is just looking for another caller to rough up or mock. And you want to watch? Laughing out loud. International Connection should issue crash helmets. Hey, Neufeld, you're falling asleep. I got to wake up.
Yeah, I know. I'm listening.
Yeah, but you just snored. Sit up.
I didn't snore. Come on, Bob.
No, because I'm answering your question, man.
Okay. I'm trying, Bob.
Yeah, I know. The day he's been...
No, because you said we're going to talk for about an hour, and just, I'm exhausted from running around and going to the beach and walking and all that stuff. You don't take naps, right? The only time I don't take naps is when I'm working at home because I'm sitting in a chair for 12, 16 hours. I don't need to.
Good. We got all that on tape. How much fun he's having here. How exhausting it is.
Yeah.
So the International Connection should issue crash helmets. Never listen. He says he never listens in real time. Sorry, and I'm not going to get up that early. Then he says, I misquoted him. His boringness was not about Duffel. He's saying Greg's boringness was not about Duffel, Greg Duffel, but is trivializing of all things Bob. That's what bored me 3,000 miles away. This guy's in either Vancouver or L.A. Hence my offhanded criticism. Compare two examples of his Bobness: International Connection versus Cash Flow. Bob Neverett singing Alleluias on the James Martinez show, example February 11th show, versus a sullen-sounding Bob Dobbs waiting to cut in as five different guys named Dave chime in. Could Duffel really think Bob's boring? Or, no, maybe he means Duffel. Could Duffel really think Duffel's boring? Not likely, since he's willing to have his Bobness on as his regular guest, despite the fact most of Greg's Toronto listeners reputedly hate the Bob. She quotes, hate the Bob. Although I just heard the last two shows, and he sounds more receptive, meaning Greg, to his Bobness. Please have Greg to institute the following. Dump Rye High, meaning Ryerson Technical School. He calls it Rye High.
Right.
It's interesting. It's got Rye in there, R-Y-E.
Yes.
Dump Rye High in the board members' discussion. So he doesn't want Greg talking as he does about the battles with management. And then he says, yes, they're bloody dimwits. Next, dump Dave. And there's all these Dave 1, 2, 3, 4, 5s that call in. Dump Dave 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. They are calling in every 15 minutes. Makes International Connection sound like a bunch of blokes waiting at a bus stop. Man, oh man, inane, trivial banter. But his Bobness loves it, so I'm pissing in the wind here. Four, dump the mockery of his Bobness. Toronto's legendary small-minded navel gazers strike again. Not Greg, but you know the score. He's saying not that Greg is like that. Sadly, Bob's earnest East Coast roots and their residue mean we get an unwavering niceness. He thinks I'm a Canadian. Partly. Come from France. And he says, Bob rules are strange dictums indeed. Bob rules. So he's sort of puzzled by my unwavering niceness. Then he says, dump all those, quote, up-to-the-minute net audio mashups that Greg organizes. He says, I love...
I should just get his own show, it sounds like.
No, but it's interesting. He says, love the TV film clips, but do we need net news rebroadcast as filler? I know, it's 2 hours long, and they don't pay you to do this stuff, but still. Six, dump the local stuff. Laughing out loud. Okay, cut back then. And he says, needs more international, in quotes, content. Stalin / Korea is overcooked.
It's embarrassing.
Have you ever
That's where Greg suspends his judgment. You notice that? He's very critical-minded. And then the minute he gets to the North Korean, oh, I hear he likes baseball and sushi.
Seems like an okay guy to me. So, Scott, you haven't heard much of International Connection recently, have you?
Yeah, I have. I've heard. I'm pretty up to date with it. There's a couple, 2 or 3 shows I haven't heard.
You know that Greg's a Stalinist and proud of it.
I don't know what's going on with Greg. He's a bit. He's doing a bit of a Manipian trip, as far as I can tell. So I don't know where his genuine heart lies. But I know he gets into it with Moron Man, and that's always a lot of fun.
Yeah, no, it seems he must be doing satire. No, Greg is an out-and-out Stalinist. He means it.
It's just bizarre.
Well, his parents were NDP.
Right.
And so he was conditioned to be a socialist, and he just thinks they were wimps, and he takes it further.
Right.
But it is, Dave can't take it.
Well, no, because if he ever really actually went to North Korea and really saw what it was like, he'd be like, I want to go home.
No, Greg's an odd guy. He was scouted for animation when he was 17, didn't have a normal, you know, out of high school life, and he went into a womb of animation, and maybe he has an immature or a weird view of social life. Like, he loves all the togetherness of the Korean, North Korean children singing together and those kind of things.
What, the ones that are like, you know, kids are like, in the parents are in the Communist Party, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
While the other ones are all starving.
Yeah.
I don't like that.
Okay, well, Dave, you're a liberal, right?
Right.
Dave?
Yeah.
Okay, so seven. Dump.
I mean, he's probably a fan of Ceausescu, too, and thinks the Romanians were dumb to have him killed. They had it so good.
Okay, seven. Dump the passive Bob. We want more obscure, nutty, off-the-wall Bobness rants, please. Then he says, dump moron man, the Zionist Englishman who's both a heckler and a mean-spirited, plus that cranky, overbearing lady, that would be Heather, who spouts, quote, secret info about outdated oligarchies. Those two have got to go. Then he says, Bob, please have Greg amp up the following. One, Disney cult insights. Voice impressions, Greg's good at that. Animation slash movie biz history. For example, is subliminal imagery possible in film? Four, challenge, he wants Greg to challenge his Bobness instead of ignoring me. Obscure musical selections. For example, that spaghetti western tune was too good. He likes to talk on obscure movies, TV, and music insights. And seven, slackness. So he wants more slackness. Cheers from the left coast, L.A. slash Honcouver. That might mean L.A., Honolulu, and Vancouver. I'm not sure. So that's a good description of what how I'm perceived in that situation. But I like being perceived in different environments. So I don't know, and that's what the chart's about, Scott. Different environments.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, it was, you know, McLuhan made it clear that you needed, that every medium had a bias, and if you knew how to play that bias when you were in that medium, you could be successful, but you had to be different in every medium.
Yeah, most people don't want to be. They want to be consistent. Wouldn't you say that, Bob? That is considered integrity.
Yes, that's the literate hang-up of, yeah, every moment is connected to the past moment. It must connect to the next one. That's linear connectedness that came from the book.
Right.
They don't understand oral and tactile culture discontinuity. Too upsetting.
Or too schizophrenic.
Right. And that's what we think it is, but
yeah,
it isn't to them. So here's the thing, though.
Quadraphrenic.
Yes. Well, that's when the Android meme mimes this dilemma.
Yeah.
This cultural division. But, Scott, when you say McLuhan shows that different environments are important, or you should be aware of the bias, being in my school, we say McLuhan is an idiot, and we join LaRouche, who does not think media environments and their differences are important. That's how you develop your schizophrenia, your quadrophenia. You dump completely and say McLuhan's wrong, and you live in another zone. And then you dump LaRouche, and you go into the Thompson-Terrence McKenna zone and think LaRouche and McLuhan are idiots. Then you go into the POMO scene with P-O-M-A, with Croker and all the postmodern theorists, and realize how silly McLuhan, Croker, LaRouche, and Thompson are. And you live in those environments for a while. That the best way to live in them temporarily, or start to, is read their books. Then you go join those seminars.
I mean, see, that creates confusion, because if the whole planet was doing it, no one would have a sense of, well, which one is really you?
Okay, Dave.
What, are you going to say, all of them?
Okay, Dave, that reminds me. I wanted to say the music that you played me on the new Most Serene stuff.
Yeah.
I could hear Broken Social Scene, what I would think is Broken Social Scene, which is really your stamp. I could hear your stuff there.
Right.
And it's good. I can tell you it's good.
Yeah.
But I got to say, you're an idiot, Dave. You don't get anything. What you just said about confusion, Dave, you generate confusion in your music. But maybe that's too harsh. You actually create a nice, I don't know, you've got a mixture, kaleidoscope in your styles on You Forgot It in Purple, that album. So for you, a guy who's handy with all kinds of textures, to say it creates confusion, that's an interesting point here. It means you have a rigid literary mind behind yourself as a core of your identity.
Mm-hmm.
And on the surface, you can play with all kinds of textures and music.
Mm-hmm.
You get what I'm getting at, Scott? That Neufeld just walked into it here. He exposed something about himself. You following this, Scott, or did you fall asleep?
No, I'm here.
Yeah, so he's saying that would create confusion to do what I'm advocating. Do you agree with that?
Well, I think no. I think you have to contemplate this thing that you call the mystery body and be willing to sort of stay there in the gap or in the mystery between the what appear to be paradoxical elements.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Dave, do you realize how confusing the world is and the many environments people naturally live in, unconsciously?
Yeah, it's like if I'm in email, I'm not necessarily going to be a bastard. Oh, I'm in the chip body now, so I can be a real jerk. Oh, now I'm in the chemical body, I got to be like that. Like, I almost would prefer someone's, kind of get that vibe when you're in that chip body, and then when I see you in person, there's still some sense of consistency or continuity. Mm-hmm. So even if that's my bias, that's my preference, too.
So you see, you require people...
I want to get some sense of, give me some sense of where you're at. Don't just say, I'm being satirical, depending on the medium. It's like, that's great, but then you feel like you're just being carried by the tides back and forth. Wherever the waves take me, I'll go, I'll roll with it.
All right, so that would be slightly Thompson and LaRouche quadrant. They believe in a self, something
right.
Consistent. LaRouche says it's... thought or some kind of intelligence,
mm-hmm.
and Thompson might say it's more mystical, the Vedanta void, but
right.
There's something consistent that is not affected. And McLuhan implied that when he said media does not affect the private citadel of consciousness, or the citadel of consciousness is how he said it.
Mm-hmm.
You believe that. And in a sense, probably most people believe that. We don't really believe that media are altering us the way McLuhan suggests.
Oh no, I think I think most people would say yeah they would. I would say that obviously, but I'd say at the same time there should be some sense of core self. This person is a miserable prick, or this person has really bad intentions, or here's a very kind-hearted soul, and all those kind of things. To me, that should shine through whatever media you're in.
Okay, as you say that, I think it helps illustrate the point. Is McLuhan once said that he some woman came in and offered a seminar on new manners in society. This would be in 78, 79. And McLuhan says, that's what we study here, manners.
Mm-hmm.
Styles and manners, the way people are. It's the surface part of life. He did say that Menippean satire is a satire on the surface aspects of life. The media environment.
We're talking about what are there some core sense?
Oh yeah, no, I got it. So, I've decided that the effect of media does not affect personal's private consciousness. It affects the collectivities, which are created by speech, books, and that. This weird collective zone, they say, you've probably heard many times in your life, somebody will say, individuals are great one-on-one, but get them in a crowd, they go nuts.
Right.
You ever heard that cliche, right?
And it seems like it's observable. It's a cliche,
yeah.
And it's observable, yeah.
Yeah, and that's a core truth, because there's something that creates a collectivity in the crowds. And a medium is a crowd. It's a crowd effect organized by the medium that allows the crowd to be in touch with each other.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the dilemma of being a human being is, how much the crowd dynamic you have to go along with. And as new technologies come in and change the crowd dynamic, it gets confusing. But most people expect people one-on-one not to be a crowd nut and can be reasonable. And
right.
Then if they're not reasonable and start chanting crowd slogans to you, then you say, that guy's a fanatic. He's lost
right.
his individual core.
Right.
And so that's the essence of what we're juggling here. How much people meet one-on-one, what they say and do with themselves, and then they have to deal with this weird other collective dimension
mm-hmm.
that is real.
Mm-hmm.
And, people, if you're talking privately before you get on a bus and you get involved with it, and it's a pretty eccentric private conversation, you probably, when you get on the bus, you don't say that because, people are listening. So you control yourself a little bit, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you can sort of see what you can talk about.
Mm-hmm.
What the crowd, what the chart is showing. The anthropomorphic physical is the sense that you're a human being and you're not the environment around you.
Mm-hmm.
Though you project that the environment has some characteristics, and different people project different ways, but then the ongoing collective media behavior is what the anthropomorphic physical consciousness or individual self is interacting with.
Mm-hmm.
That, so the Dobbs quadrant, Rumpelstiltskin quadrant, is sort of the essence of a human thinking, I'm here, but I'm not just this.
Mm-hmm.
But I often project that there is things like me out there.
Mm-hmm.
That's the anthropomorphic projection. But the anthropomorphic physical, what I mean by that is just the idea you're here and you're human and you're sort of different from the environment you're in.
Mm-hmm.
Interacting with the crowd dynamics as history unfolds, technological memes, is the dilemma for the AP, anthropomorphic physical, interacting with now the android meme, the ultimate crowd dynamic, which replays itself and makes itself invisible and tries to say, you are in charge. It tries to reinforce subtly that you should feel detached and not involved in the crowd.
Right.
So, Scott, you have something to interject there at this point. Is this interesting to you?
Don't need to say this, but since you're probing me, I'll just tell you what was coming into my head when I was thinking about one of the things that Lily understood working with Oscar Chazo is how people are fragmented into different selves, you know, I mean, different parts. They will flip into different personalities depending upon what the circumstances are evoking or provoking, and not even recognize the lack of consistency between the different selves that they display or that they engage in different environments, from the work environment to the home environment,
role
to the bedroom and so on. Yeah. And so...
Yeah, that relates. That's an ongoing puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
Where can you demand a person be conscious of how they're aligning themselves with the surface manners and forgetting themselves? And it's very hard to interrupt people and break that out, because they probably think they are conscious and know what they're doing. You just didn't follow what their rules were. It gets touchy when you start interfering with people on that level.
Right.
Pointing you. What?
Yeah, I was agreeing.
Yeah, so the... I was just thinking that probably Dave, I know exactly what he means. You have contact with someone who seems to be consistent through all the necessary social postures you take.
Right.
I know that Dave would think I'm one of those people. He feels there's someone constant all through his contact with me. And I would say the same with Dave. But it's funny that I'm engaged in talking about the surface world, what appears to be the surface. But I'm raising the question that... that the need for that consistency among people,
mm-hmm.
that's being threatened today. People don't have any community to stay aligned to.
Right.
So we're becoming quadriphenic, and we've got to figure out how to feel comfortable as people lose their continuity for what you think.
Yeah.
And then that's even confusing, because some people think they're probably maintaining their continuity, but they don't have a reference that you use for your continuity, and then that's... Then they would say, no, I'm more Neufeld than Neufeld is. You know what I mean? As Neufeld laid out the value. So that's the question that we're involved in right now. As McLuhan said, there's a confusion now between the private and public spaces. No, private and public awareness. That's really what's going on. Mm-hmm. And the idea that we go cyborg, all you're doing is putting on a virtual reality helmet maybe and just going off being by yourself for a few hours and hallucinating
mm-hmm.
in some little matrix coffin.
Yes.
Does that really affect people? And that's the argument. Does that make people lose their continuity? But you notice when you think across society, and think of society, everybody says, there's madness out there.
Yes.
And that's because on the surface manner level, there's so many different media interacting that the sense that there must be sort of a shared space that people agree is surface mannerism, it's getting confused.
Yeah.
On top of the ongoing dilemma, is my buddy aware of himself and constant?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's, and then the android meme, I think, plays back that doubleness question.
And McLuhan, of course, he always would push that whole angle that all the media scrub identity.
Yeah.
So how do you have an identity when you've got all these massively refined media that are working us over, the television, radio environment, the chip environment? It's about a very high level refined stage. And I guess, is that what you ultimately talk about your mystery body? Not the mystery body. No, that is the mystery body, right?
Yeah.
Where do these other bodies all juggle together? What kind of new body is created, or a new kind of person. And that's
right.
For us, just, and partially the new, it's ultimately going to be, because we're humans, based on our human civilization, that it's all going to ultimately go back to values that we've had for 6,000-7,000 years. They all, you know what I mean, they can't just be trashed all at once.
What medium are those values going to be presented on?
Well, they would work their way into all of them. You have basic core values you would assume, like religion offers, or Ten Commandments, or whatever, that you would think would be consistent in all these media.
So you think religious values will become stronger?
I don't think they'll become stronger necessarily, but for me, I just think, well, that's a basic model that you'd think would be some sense of consistency that humans could apply. Well, we'll all agree on that. We shouldn't murder each other. We shouldn't lie. We shouldn't do all this other stuff. And you would think that those would be basic values that would be usable or could be applied in any of these environments. And they're not incompatible with all these media either, really, ultimately.
Yeah, no, there's a lot in there, because that would explain why fundamentalism has come back.
Mm-hmm.
And also the...
But what, is the sense that we need these anchors?
Yeah.
Fundamentalism is more of a contraction and a reflexive response. It's fear-based, I think.
Yeah, it is more so, isn't it? That kind of pulls back to like a Norman Rockwell era that doesn't actually really exist.
So you mean by forget the religious trappings, just agree that we shouldn't kill each other?
You don't have to, it doesn't have to be packaged in religion. Is more, I think, is just ethics, basic morality and ethics that usually theoretically cut across most religious institutions anyways. They're actually fairly consistent. Most of them all kind of agree on that.
So the
golden rule is pivotal here, I think.
Exactly, and most religions ultimately will espouse that. Just treat other people the way you expect to be treated, and things should be okay. Unless you're a maniac and you are masochistic, but that's not the majority of people.
Yeah, so you're saying that you're waking up the idea when people meet, say an Asian meets a Canadian,
mm-hmm.
that they ignore their cultural
values.
Trappings and look at each other as two anthropomorphic human projectors.
Right.
And meet on that level.
Mm-hmm.
Which, by the way, people tend to be able to do when they're neighbors and they meet each other one-on-one. It's more the group mentality where the frictions begin to happen and then the people take sides.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's funny. In that sense, you know, the classic cliche, the veneer of civilization is really thin. And don't forget, too, as McLuhan pointed out, is that when their identities are scrubbed and they're in this sphere where they don't have bodies, then that, a lot of their, you know, the sort of social inhibitions go away, you know, or people are suddenly, like, posting pictures of themselves nude on Craigslist and stuff like that. Normally, they would never do that for their next-door neighbors, but they will do it in this even, ultimately, larger environment. So these are, I guess, yeah, the qualities of these different media that do obviously alter us, and so then is there any kind of consistency? And I think you will see it spill over, because if people start more and more posing pictures of themselves, say, nude on Craigslist, they're going to feel less inhibited about their neighbors seeing them nude eventually, you know what I mean? As you get, used to, acclimatized to that. So I think in that sense, it is this mystery body that you speak of, Bob, because it's all these different attributes and qualities, they do start to permeate the other media. They would have to. They can't ultimately be completely separated. And you can see that, whether it's in literature or television. Look at the content of stuff in the 50s compared to the stuff now on TV. I mean, obviously, we've totally changed on all levels, you know, and eventually people just walking down the street, they're like, oh, I'm into porn, I'm into all this stuff, you know. So I think what we're seeing is the so-called mystery body, the amalgamation of effects of all these other environments, and where do we all come out? And I think it's like a push-pull, and eventually out of all that, you'll get some kind of basic averages or basic qualities that will remain, and hopefully they'll be good ones.
Right. The recent posting of on the McLuhan list of McLuhan's first article, No, it was the Technology and Culture article. He, in 1952, it's like his first article once he got tenure, so he started to go a little into the media analysis more publicly. He begins by saying that technology, has brought people together all around the world, but still there is metaphysical isolation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting, metaphysical isolation means the one, the anthropomorphic physical person looking at the other guy,
mm-hmm.
that where do they connect? Now, they use language and social behavior to feel unified. If that collapses in the chaos of the present, then they only have to rely on the one-on-one meeting and begin to overcome maybe their metaphysical isolation, or realize they can't overcome it. That's the question. So, and the metaphysical isolation is the mystery of what human consciousness is. That's the mystery landscape, is we don't know really what we are.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know where we came from, where we're going. And we've got lots of interpretations.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're now confronting the metaphysical isolation factor, because we've unified so many ways, and yet we have a lot of variety in different media, like you were saying, but people still don't feel connected, or they're trying, why can't we all get along? That's someone projecting, feeling that there's some kind of isolation going on, even though we've all imploded in the Android meme.
Mm-hmm.
And the Android meme does give us autonomy on the surface where we can do what we want. So the question is, what is the mystery landscape? Why is it metaphysically isolation? Maybe it isn't. How much, as McLuhan says, spoken word is the flower of evil. How much does the surface communication means, which are used to keep people together so that they can overcome their metaphysical isolation, how much does that add to the metaphysical isolation, or have nothing to do with it?
Well, people don't even get to think about metaphysical isolation if they're not getting their basic needs met. That's, Maslow. I mean, first you have to be fed, and then you have to be warm and have a place to sleep. And
that's people's first priority.
Yeah.
Their overriding thought, and that's why most people get up in the morning and go to work.
Right.
It motivates people just to get out of bed.
A woman wrote a book on cannibalism, she said, you'd be surprised. Cannibalism is in the history of humanity has not only been confined to, what people imagine to be primitive tribes. It's happened in the context of very sophisticated civilizations where things broke down to the point where the survival, the hunger, became so strong.
I mean, it was
in quote unquote civilized people that they engaged in cannibalism.
Yeah, in World War II, they said that after the war, the people would sell meat, and you didn't really ask what this is because it could have been someone they found at the side of the road. Oh, it's stew.
Yeah.
Stuff them in a sausage. Yeah, it's true. That's the thing. And again, like the veneer of civilization and the classic cliche, it's like if there's like one bathroom and two people, everything's okay. There's one bathroom and there's 10 people, tempers flare.
Yeah.
So a lot of our values are based on our where we are culturally and historically, that we can afford to have these kind of values and that. But that doesn't mean that that's our core behavior. Ultimately, it doesn't mean that's the essence of us, because you put us in a rough situation and a lot of people will alter their what seems like their core values.
Yeah, so that if the 10 people start fighting over the one toilet,
yeah,
some people are a little more sensitive or
will try and control, have more tolerance, or will say, look, let's try and make, okay, you go first, I'll wait, or that other people will just like be in
smash
demands. Yeah,
right. And the people some of the people will feel very depressed about what they just witnessed.
Right.
And will feel isolated.
Right.
So how much are people being brought down right now by what they think has collapsed? How much are they feeling isolated?
Mm.
So this is the doubleness. How much your personal consciousness,
mm-hmm.
And how much you think there's collective consciousness.
Right.
And that's a paradox.
Big debate, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, that's a part of being a member of society.
Yeah.
You don't have that choice, really. That debate is an ongoing thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Where do I fit in the whole thing? I'm amazed, like, when you can, whether you're sitting at a restaurant or anything, I just constantly will hear conversations where ultimately the essence of it is the two people are talking are basically saying, God, everyone's just stupid out there. They're so stupid.
Yeah, millions of people are saying that.
Yeah, millions of people think that everyone else is stupid.
And they're really saying, Well, you know, we can talk one-on-one, but but you get people together in the crowd. Now it's an Android meme, 6 billion people all inside a seamless web. It looks that the manners, social level of media is nuts.
Yeah.
And yet it's not people are nuts, because everybody's saying privately, well,
these guys are crazy. Can you believe it?
Yeah, the group mind out there is really screwed up.
Yeah.
Okay, I just need to take a break.
Right.
We'll continue.